Welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Ritt, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro by Mr. David Holmes and producer Miles. Good afternoon, chaps.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are we both doing?
Yeah, not so bad. Not so bad. It's been a good week. Yourself?
Voice, it's always nice to hear that after the podcast you are not so bad.
The podcast is a highlight, and it's kind of downhill from that point.
Yeah, agreed. It's the highlight of our week. We just enjoy it so much, don't we? It sounds almost sarcastic, but we do genuinely enjoy it. And today's chat again was a good one. We say this every week, but really enjoyed that. So we had part two of our chat about personal data breaches, didn't we? It wasn't actually just the two of us, Dave and I, but we were also joined by Carrie again this week. Carrie, who can't make this intro because she's got another commitment, unfortunately, but it was great to have the two of you on. I very much enjoyed kicking those ideas around. Any particular bits that stood out to you, Dave?
Yeah, I quite like the just kind of looking at kind of remoteness and causation, and you helping me out with my very poor knowledge that we returned from law school around the ordinary person test and the eggshell skull concept.
Yes, you can tell that those were all things that we covered in first year, because that's when I was actually going to my lectures. Oops. didn't hold me back, clearly. But
memories flooding back. It didn't go with you.
All flooding back, yeah, exactly.
As soon as mentioned, you're just like, yes, that's what I need to remember.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be expecting your essay on my desk next week. It was good. We also spoke a little bit about what's been in the news, didn't we? We talked about the Clearview AI fine. We talked about a particularly interesting case coming out of the Court of Justice for the European Union, which I thought was particularly interesting, but didn't seem to get as much traction as I expected it to. Good episode all around. As I mentioned on the session, we are not going to be live next week. We are instead going to be doing a pre-recorded episode, Dave and I, and anyone else who wants to join that from the DPP side. Because it is the bank holiday weekend. What's it called, Dave? The special episode that's pre-recorded, the title of which you came up with?
You're going to make me say it again.
Yeah, no excuse this time. So live on the session, Dave tried to claim that he'd forgotten the name of it, despite the fact that he's the one who came up with it, so he made me say it.
So but now there's no excuse. The lovely Jubilee, or a play on Jubilee podcast.
Yeah. There you go. I wanted you to say it out loud.
He said that with no confidence.
Absolutely not.
Well, I said it with no confidence because I was hoping that there might have been like little pause that gets clipped out. So I was thinking, I can't be the one. This is going to be the end of my career on the podcast.
Listen, Dave, you come up with some great titles, but unfortunately, you can't be consistent every week. Sometimes there's got to be a bit of a stinker in there thrown in for good measure. But yeah, we'll be doing that episode and we'll be releasing that across the usual feeds. So that's on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts, and most importantly on the DPP website under the resources section. You can go up there and find all the previous episodes. They're available same day because producer Miles works hard on a Friday afternoon to get them out on time. Would also like to point out at this juncture that you can still, if you enjoy the podcast, leave us a review on Trustpilot, name drop Dave, Miles and I in particular, or Carrie if you enjoyed her contributions today, although she's got plenty of reviews already, so maybe just mention Dave and I. And if you've got any other feedback at all for us on the podcast, how we do things, how we can improve it, do let us know. You know, get in touch and we'll see if we can do them. I know some people skip this intro, which, you know, fair enough. Want to get straight into the meat of the conversation, right?
I appreciate that. And just to kind of pick up on the leaving the review, if you like the puns and the bad jokes and things, and do put a comment about the fact that you think you need to remain, otherwise I may end up leaving if I start losing the plot with some of the points that I come out with.
Listen, Dave, people turn up just for you some weeks, so I won't.
You mean turn off? You're getting your words wrong. You turn off just because of
No, honestly, the numbers take a hit when you're not about. So, yeah, no, if you do enjoy, let us know. And if you've got any feedback at all, then we would really appreciate it. On that note, Dave, I know that you've got another engagement that you need to dash off to. So we will let you go and we will leave the listeners in the very capable hands of David Holmes, Carrie James and myself. Why don't you tell us a little little bit about Clearview AI.
Yeah, and I was just reading through. There's they've had, and I'm sure we'll have seen it or potentially looked about it. The headline grabbing news with Clearview AI is the fine that's been issued. But if you go into the ICO's enforcement page, they've actually had two actions against them. One is the fine, the monetary penalty notice for about £7.5 million or something in that kind of region. But they've also got an enforcement action. And I took the lesser of the two documents and started reading the enforcement. So it's kind of working with that document. It's really quite interesting, some of the bits. So the enforcement ultimately is the fact that they've got an enforcement notice to say that within 6 months they've got to delete all of the data that relates to the UK. So if we just kind of go back and unpick a little bit, Clearview AI, for those who don't know, operated kind of an algorithmic image search engine. So you could search for people, you could upload images and try and find other people or find matches similar to themselves. And it's a global thing that they were doing, and the information was obtained through scraping public-facing internet sites and that kind of thing. So they had some astonishing figures, actually. There was, I just made a couple of notes down here, there was a database of 20 billion images.
It's quite 20
billion, huge, isn't it?
Yeah,
And the images involved that were scraped involved obviously the metadata, the images, and links to where you could see more about the individual and that kind of thing. It was the couple of the interesting parts in there was the fact that the it was held that from a fairness point. Although the images were made available on a public facing internet, it would not be within the individual's expectations for those images to be scraped and added to a worldwide database and made available to a range of customers. In that sense, as we all know. But then it actually went on a bit further, and Clearview suggested that the images on public facing internet are placed there voluntarily by the individuals who were within the image, and therefore without any unfairness you're able to be collected and used for whatever purposes whatsoever, which was deemed to be wholly misconceived as an argument, which I thought was quite amusing.
I carry by all means, you know, come in on this, but I really hate that line of arguing, like the idea that simply because it's in the public domain, you can do whatever you want with it. Because it's been quoted at me before where, you know, organizations will go, oh, yeah, but, you know, it's public domain. Well, it doesn't matter. It's still someone's information. Like, there's no public domain exemption. It's not a real thing. Yes, there are conditions in very specific circumstances that allow processing based on a lawful basis of it being made manifestly public, but I really hate that line of inquiry.
I also do. I don't think just because somebody's put an image onto the internet doesn't mean it was put there for the purpose of scraping and that kind of thing. And as was held, or as at least come out with the ICO's and within the ICO's enforcement notice, claiming that the individual who is the kind of the subject of the image put it there voluntarily is rather misconceived as well, in the grounds of the fact that you may well not be the person who's the focus of the image, and it may contain other people's images, and that's going upon or being scraped and used and so on and so forth. You can't just assume that it's an image of one person that's been uploaded, that kind of thing.
No, for sure.
There was a lot of issues in there. I would like to read the monetary penalty notice as well, and I've got it down to read, but there's clearly issues with things like transparency and lawfulness and things within that. But what was interesting was that the decision to for the enforcement notice relied on, they took kind of guidance, really. I don't know if you got to this far. It stays down in point 76. Where the commissioner considered whether it's practicable for Clearview to comply with the requirements to delete the data in that sense, in the timescales that's detailed out within Annex 1 of the enforcement notice. And within that regard, the commissioner notes proceedings brought in a US district court for the Northern District of Illinois between Mutnick and others versus Clearview. And in there, the court held the things that needed to be done was they need to block all photographs in the database that were geolocated in Illinois. from being searched. Constructed geofence around around Illinois. Decide that will not collect facial vectors from images that contain metadata associated with anybody in Illinois. And will not collect facial vectors from images stored on servers that are displaying an Illinois IP address. So because that's already come out as a case law, although US in that sense, the commissioner thought, well, it's not going to be too hard to do something similar in the UK, which I thought was quite interesting.
Could we have that in English, please, Dave? Well, no, it is interesting. It is interesting. I jest, of course. It is interesting. I didn't realise that the detail had been published, in all honesty, because in a slightly unconventional turn, I don't know if anyone else was aware of this, but the decision was announced on Monday, maybe? Yeah, it was announced on Monday because we were in our consultants meeting, and no detail was provided. It was just, we're doing this. You'll find out more about it in due course, which is a very strange approach to take, considering especially that it's only taken them, you know, till the end of the week to publish it. So why not sit on it for a bit? Strange PR decision.
They do run for a few pages. So I'm a little bit tongue in cheek, but I'm guessing we're still typing it up, but thought they'd go with the headline news.
Yeah, fair enough.
But it is really interesting. I would urge you to go and read it. There are some fascinating bits in there, such as when they were looking at, can you delete images relating to the UK, Clearview, not really, we don't know where it is, that kind of, in essence. We don't know how much we got, we don't know how much relates to the UK, and because we don't know that, we won't be able to delete it, kind of argument, but still, they've now got 6 months to do so. But do go ahead and have a read, it's really, really interesting to go and read.
Yeah, no, I very much intend to. Kerry, I don't know if there's anything that you wanted to raise in particular, because... Again, as I've said for the past...
I was just letting Dave have the moment.
Yeah, this is the thing.
Really passionate on this one.
As I've said for the past few weeks, I do feel an inclination to make sure you're given the space, because otherwise, yes, our favourite soapbox merchant does have a tendency to hog the microphone. So I don't know if you had anything that you wanted to bring in on this in particular, or any other news items that you wanted to raise. I've put a few in our session plan here, but...
Yeah. On this one, I do agree with you, Ollie, that it's... I don't think their defence of, it's publicly available information is good enough. Because for me, when I think of the lawful basis, so it says manifestly made public, I'd think that, okay, so the data subjects made it public, but then the manifestly is they've got to have done something to further push it out there. Like it's got to have been sort of released wider, like in a press disclosure or something, you know, not just uploading a Facebook photo. Because that's not manifestly making it public. That's just a very small sphere of people that are going to see that. It's not public as such. It's just a small group. Just find it mind-boggling what they're doing with all these images.
Yeah, it is quite concerning. And actually, on that note, I just wanted to raise, and I don't know if anyone else had seen this, but it was quite big news earlier this week, and it particularly affects some of our colleagues and customers, I'm sure. But the Human Rights Watch report into the edtech sector, education tech, which is a very, very interesting read, and I know has, you know, struck fear into the hearts of many, because there's some revelations in that which are quite startling. So I don't know if either of you came across this, but effectively, a big human rights group, advocacy group, I say, has led this investigation. They've looked at, I think, just under 200 of these sort of ed tech providers. So primarily solutions which provide, an option to monitor children within an education context on their devices. And the report reckons that up to 89% of those products are deemed to infringe on children's rights in some capacity, which is quite startling. They also, and the big revelation, of course, is that for anyone that's followed it, is that far more of these solutions were providing access to children's data for marketing and advertising purposes than should have been the case, i.e. the case being that it should have been none of them doing that, realistically, because you shouldn't really be monitoring children to keep them safe, but using that data for marketing purposes. That's just, you just can't, and you shouldn't. Yeah, I don't know if either of you had any thoughts on this, but it's definitely one to keep an eye on. I think for the UK, interestingly, a lot of the recommendations that are coming out of this are things which are already covered by the Age-Appropriate Design Code of Practice, which is interesting. So that if you're already complying with that, there are a number of recommendations that you will already have met or surpassed, I believe. I don't know that, I can't say that for certain, but certainly the AADCOP, which is not necessarily a good acronym, but that sets you in pretty good stead in respect of some of the things that are coming out of this report. Certainly one to keep an eye on, I think. Any thoughts on that?
Sort of concerning then that these organisations are not really thinking of children versus adult data. It sounds like they're just lumping it all in as one, maybe, that they're treating children's data the way they would treat adults' data, which is, oh, let's just target some marketing ads at it, and not really giving it that extra consideration, extra sensitivity that it needs because it's children's data.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, but I do still think that in context, I just said regardless of the end user, it's kind of not appropriate to use that data for marketing purposes.
Like if they've not opted in.
Yeah, I'm possibly being a little bit emotional, a bit tyrannical about it, but I don't think that where you're talking about solutions which are intended to guarantee the safety of children online, that anyone's data should be used for marketing purposes. It doesn't sit brilliantly with me, regardless of whether they're adult or not. I mean, if someone's been informed of it all and has opted in, fine. But yeah, it leaves a bit of a sour taste as far as I'm concerned. Sorry, Dave, you were going to say something?
No. I was just sitting back to pass over the soapbox.
Yes, okay, fine. I will move swiftly on in that case from this. There are a few other bits I wanted to talk about. One in particular, which I think is fascinating, but I might leave that till last possibly because it's a nice segue into talking about breaches. I also wanted to cover off, and I don't know if either of you had anything to include at this point, but I've seen there's been an increase in the number of enforcement action from European regulators relating to terminating staff email accounts. I don't know if either of you saw this, but there were a couple of instances in the last couple of weeks, one Italian, one Norwegian, that I've picked out, where basically an organization has been fined because they have terminated a member of staff's access to emails, but those work emails contain both business and personal emails, and that's been deemed to be an infringement. And it's interesting because the CNIL were talking about this not a few months back, and we mentioned it on the podcast. They produce some quite good, quite comprehensive guidance on the subject, and I think it's interesting to see that applied in practice.
So just go through that one again. I was just while you're talking, I was thinking that there was another case
maybe a few months ago.
No, I was. I was just trying to wrap my brain of something else that had occurred a few weeks. It's not weeks. It must have been a few months ago now, where there was something similar about.
I think that you're right. It was a Danish one, I think, at the time, if memory serves. But yeah, I mean, basically, it's members, from what I can tell, which is a skim read, so please don't jump down my throat about it. But from what I can tell, it's members of staff who are leaving employment, who are being investigated in HR context, who are being suspended, whatever. But they've had their work email account inbox suspended or terminated or the access revoked, either way.
Disabled, that kind of thing, yeah.
Disabled, that's the word I'm looking for. But that inbox doesn't just contain work emails, it also contains some personal emails. And they're saying, I want access to it. The company's saying, no, you can't have access to it. It's our servers. If there's personal stuff in there, it shouldn't be in there. They're work emails. And basically the rationale seems to be that, well, no, staff have a right to use these communication channels, sometimes for personal reasons, and you can't simply revoke their access unequivocally. You know, they have a right to access some of that information, and you should be providing them with it, as far as I can tell.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I would have said they've got access to their data through a subject access request. If they put it in for access to the email content, that kind of thing. I get the fact that if you're using work emails for personal reasons, ideally you really ought to have something within your inbox kind of saying personal, so then the employers knows the areas not to go looking if they're looking for work purposes, that kind of thing. But if somebody's particularly disgruntled, they could do a lot of damage by giving them access back to their inbox just because they claim they want to use it for accessing private emails in that sense. I would have said, well, we'll pull them off and give it to you under a subject access request. Not got any kind of issues with that in that sense. But I'm just a bit cautious that it is. I can see where potentially why they're saying that, but I can also see potentially the damage that may be caused from particularly disgruntled employees that may have a wealth for of sure. information hanging around within their inbox that they could then use to further for malicious purposes.
No, for sure. And we only need to cast our minds back to last week or the week before last, where we had a story about that person deleting all the appointments for the spa and being done under the Computer Misuse Act. I mean, you know, it's a very good point, Dave. I think part of the issue, more than anything, is that they are refusing to provide even copies. So as James says in the chat, he's been in that situation and the company provided copies of personal emails, not the business ones, which, well, certainly providing copies seems reasonable. The issue of whether to provide the business ones as well is a slightly more complex question. Well,
I get the point that if you're refusing any access, therefore in essence refusing a subject access request would be kind of saying you're not going to give any effect to rights and the right of access in that sense. So I can understand saying you can't bar access completely, but giving them access back to an inbox, I think potentially has got to be balanced with the greater risk of harm. That may be caused. There may well be, as you know, individuals will send files to each other containing personal data. So there may well be within the inbox languishing around information on your customers, your tenants, depending on what your organisation is. Could be commercially sensitive stuff languishing around in there as well. And I thought the going from a risk-based approach, I would be saying, yes, you can't refuse access to personal data, but you could give access to it through a subject access request in order to ensure access to commercial data that could be used maliciously is mitigated sufficiently.
Sure thing. Yeah. No, I think that's reasonable. But go on, Carrie.
I was going to say, like, how long do they actually intend this to go on for then? So they say that you can't block employees' access to their emails for personal use, for business use, whatever, even though it looks like it's going to set a very dangerous kind of, like what Dave was saying, people can do a lot of damage in a very short amount of time if they're disgruntled. But then are they saying, like, at what point can the employer actually close that access off? Like, what have they got to be gone a number of years, but they're still allowed access? Can I keep my DPP email address forever?
No, you can't.
I don't want to. It's fine. I'll give it back.
I don't know why you would want it. But
it's like, if they're saying that they can have it for personal emails, is it just for the... Like, would that person want access to? If they're not giving back a SAR, then that's an issue. But you'd think the fine would then be under SAR, or the action would be under SAR, rather than the fact that they've removed access.
Yeah, to be clear, allow me to clarify. Reading it now, it seems to indicate that the member of staff is still employed. But it's not a very good translation I'm working with, unfortunately. It's an Italian piece of enforcement. From what I can tell, it's a member of staff who's still employed, and because they're sending a couple of business personal emails from their business account, it's been suspended, and they're refusing to give them access to it back, despite the fact that they're still a member of staff, which is odd. It's odd.
I feel like it's quite standard, though, if you're going through a disciplinary procedure and you've been suspended, to not have access to work systems whilst you're in suspension.
It doesn't say necessarily they've been suspended or anything. I'm not entirely... Listen, I shouldn't have brought this up because clearly I haven't read it.
We need more detail.
Yeah, clearly. Tell you what, leave that one with me. I'll go away and read it and I'll come back to you next week. But I did think it was interesting that the CNIL was talking about this a couple of months ago, and we've seen subsequently two pieces of enforcement action within quick succession. That's the main reason I raised it. Apologies for not doing my research properly. Yeah, so I don't know if there's anything else to throw in. Obviously, we need to get onto breaches very shortly. One thing I really, really want to bring up, and I don't think there's anything that either of you two want to raise, but the one I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if anyone else has seen this, is a CJEU case, which is Meta, the Facebook parent company, against the Federation of German Consumer Organizations, which I know doesn't sound like riveting reading, but I promise you it is very interesting. Essentially, this comes down to the fact that this Federation of German Consumer Organizations, so basically a consumer group, consumer rights protection group, effectively, attempted to bring a class action style lawsuit against Facebook, Meta, for Data Protection Act, well, German Data Protection Act, violations, breaches, which, you know, led to unlawful, opaque processing of data, XYZ, all the stuff that we know that Facebook gets up to. Mm-hmm. And Facebook's first port of call was to say, you can't bring this type of action. you as a consumer organization are not allowed to represent on sort of an opt-out basis all of these individual consumers. And so it went to the CJEU. And basically what it's come down to is them saying, well, actually, Article 80 does allow for this type of action. It does allow for individuals to be represented by a group or an individual, you know, acting on their behalf. And further, the law also allows member states to apply their own interpretations to that and potentially expand the scope of that. And the German courts saw no issue with this group representing, you know, all these consumers in such a way that, you know, this action basically doesn't require the group to identify any particular affected individual. They can simply raise the infringement and highlight, you know, the number of users and bring, or the estimated number of users, and bring a representative action on their behalf without having to identify anyone. Now, if we remember, this is one of the key things that Lloyd v. Google fell on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be able to demonstrate harm. Well, that's not necessarily been the point of contention, but it's interesting to see that this type of action has gotten this far. I say all the way to the CJEU and back, and they're not opposed to it. There's a really, really good write-up from people over at Pinsent Masons on this. It's just a summary that I read earlier. I will pop the link in the chat for those that are interested. But I think for anyone who's into this sort of, you know, development of the case law around actions for damages under data protection law, it's very interesting and would highly recommend. Thoughts?
I wonder whether the CJEU's stance was, I'm not necessarily against class action, but you're still going to have to prove harm and so on and so forth. You know what I mean? Where you got, coming back to the Google versus Lloyd, but kind of going, in essence, we've got no issues about class actions as such, but you're still going to have to go through the rest of the hoops. Possibly. I don't know if the opinion was limited just to, do you agree with class action or not, kind of essence.
Yes, I think it was a very specific question that was put to them. And that question was, you know, is this type of action allowed to fly? I saw someone just put their hand up there very quickly. I don't know if anyone wants to comment on this. Sorry, I'm just trying to find out who it is. David Britton? Or is that raised hand a mistake? I know sometimes it can be. I will take it that is likely a mistake. But no, it's interesting to you know, see this developing. I think, as I say, it's a very specific question that was put to them, and which they have ruled on.
Because the generally answer specific questions, they don't kind of go, well, what would you approach to this piece? I think if the question was, does Article 82, whatever it is, permit class action, then they're probably going, well, it does permit class action. We're not really against class action, but then obviously there's still a lot of hoops to get through in order to pursue class action and in all that kind of sense.
And you might find that the action fails in the exact same way that Lloyd v. Google did.
Yeah.
They can't prove harm. You're allowed to bring it without identifying specific individuals, but you're going to really struggle to prove harm if you don't do so. So
that kind of thing, yeah.
Very interesting, I thought. Anyway, cool. So any more on news? There are a couple of other items that I'd raised, but I don't think any of them are massively important at this stage. So I'm happy to start talking about breaches unless there's anything that either of you guys wanted to raise at this point.
I was just going to say, it's probably just keeping an eye on the clock might be best to kind of get into breaches part two.
We most certainly can. Right, so for those of you who were with us last week, we spent some time talking about personal data breaches. We spoke about the dictionary definition, or rather the GDPR definition, shall we say, of what we mean by a personal data breach. We spoke a little bit about the concept potential value of a near miss, didn't we? We also spoke about the reporting requirements associated with that. And then we just spoke about sometimes the practicalities, reporting internally, you know, how do you promote people internally notifying and reporting personal data breaches, and we had some really, really good conversations about all of that. But there are a few bits that we felt we wanted to come back to. And I don't have anywhere in particular to start on this, to be honest with you both. But one of the things that I thought, so I went back and checked the chat from last time, because that was, we had some really good interactions on this. And one thing that was raised is that someone was saying that they sometimes struggle with quantifying risk. So how do you actually determine the value and likelihood of risk? And I think it's a really good point. It's something that I, when I first started working in this area, really struggled with when I was asked to do breach write-ups. You know, you're given the facts, but then what's worst case scenario? And it really does take quite a bit of creativity almost, doesn't it, to come up with, you know, the most, you know, the worst case scenario sometimes. And I wondered if either of you had any things in particular that you might look at in that context, whether there's anything, whether you've got any tips in terms of thinking about that, or whether actually I'm placing too greater emphasis on that full stop, and whether maybe, you know, thinking too hypothetically is actually counterproductive in that context. Sorry, that's an incredibly loaded question, I appreciate, but
I think there is a bit of a danger in playing the what if game. You know, well, what if this happens, but then what if this happens, and what if this happens, and suddenly you can find yourself, you know, everything's so risky that you're reporting everything because you can play the what if game to that extent. I always try to, when I'm sort of assessing risk, is what has actually happened, and then what is the, like, the most immediate outcome that could possibly happen, and what is the likelihood of that. And I think when assessing risk, what's really important is getting the staff members who are in that team, that department, or the person who's done the breach, getting their input as well of what they think is actually going to happen, because a lot of the times they're the ones that may know the data subjects, how they're going to react. I'm thinking when I worked in the councils, you know, we had social workers we could ask for this kind of information of how do you think the family is going to react if they are told this. And I think you need that input from the teams to be able to really quantify the risk in a, you know, in a realistic way. I don't know if you agree, Dave. I don't know if I'm the only person that thinks the what if game is a bit, you know,
well,
extreme, kind of useful.
Yeah, kind of. As you're going through there, it kind of just took me back to my days when I was studying law. And Ollie might be able to pick up on this as well.
This will be good, Carrie.
It's not that good. I'm not trying to overcook it. But no, when we looked at causation in things like breach of contract or a breach of duty, and you look to remoteness and things that the output or the element can't be too remote from.
Is it reasonably foreseeable that the consequences would occur as a result of the actions of the defendant?
See, you're far better than me. I've just got some
loose... That type of thing.
Yeah, I've just got some loose concepts in my head, but yeah, they're far better. And then you kind of, looking at remoteness, and you're then also looking at the kind of an ordinary person test, aren't you, if you're looking back to the remote days back in law school, when you're kind of looking at how would this affect, or what would the effect of this be on an ordinary person, not somebody that's potentially... got different susceptibilities around different bits and pieces.
I think what you're referring to there is the eggshell skull principle, Dave.
Absolutely. There you go. You see, you must have listened to law school. I've got some vague memories from many, many moons ago, but in essence, yes. So because you've got that concept and you carry it with you, then you do kind of, in essence, what you just kind of explained there, Carrie, is you kind of go in, well, if you're looking at likelihood, the more remote you go, the less the likelihood it will be of occurring, right?
Yeah.
Because it's too remote. So you're kind of still talking about the same thing. But that's kind of where my thoughts were on it as you're kind of going through that the process. And I would agree. I've certainly seen some clients, I don't know if you've come across it, Ollie or Carrie, I've certainly seen some clients with their breach reporting forms and things that's got risk calculators in them. So that the numerical values against bits and pieces in order to say, well, if it's this value based on a grid, then X, Y, and Z, that kind of thing. Have you come across those yourself? Are they any good?
Sorry, I didn't mean to be so dramatic with my yes then, but that, I can't believe that we've gone this long talking about breaches and none of us have mentioned the dreaded, you know, scoring system on a breach. Carrie, I know you've got some strong thoughts and feelings.
I like them. I think they're useful. I think they're useful. I think it's helpful for people initially figuring out, and I think it makes them think about things more in depth. Your risk matrix has to be good, has to be thought out, has to be relevant, but I think they can work really well if you implement them well, if you do them right. If you've only had like rubbish ones, then maybe it doesn't work, but I think it takes away some of the I can't think of the word, like where everybody's doing it differently, which is what I've experienced in a team. I might see risk in a different way to somebody else, and then you end up with very similar breaches all being risk rated in different ways because everybody's got their own slight way of doing it, whereas bringing in a matrix can standardize how an organization sees that risk to that particular breach.
I partly agree. I think a calculation can help with putting a numerical figure to a risk element, but the point I think you're kind of getting to is the difficulty with some of it is the fact that risk is actually subjective.
It doesn't work 100% in every case, but in my experience, if you can get it, you know, tweak it. I suppose it depends on as well how many breaches I've had experience of before.
For sure.
Or how many you've got.
But the point that risk is subjective, you may score something higher or lower, regardless of a numerical value or not. You may score something higher or lower than Hollywood, and I may be something different to the both of you because of how subjective risk is. And it's you may be generally falling back on experience or knowledge or anything else to help make that calculable score. But risk is subjective.
Sorry, go on, Ali.
Oh, I was just going to joke and say, yeah, of course, because I've got no regard for my own personal integrity. But no, go on.
No, it's sort of like this is where it sort of depends on the questions you're asking. So rather than asking loads of subjective questions, you need to ask factual ones. So has it gone external to the organisation? Does it contain special category data? Things that you can definitely say yes or no to and that everybody would come to the right answers on for the majority of it. Yes, assessing the risk could be slightly different, but then you can give examples of, you know, this is what we call a medium risk, this is what we call a high risk.
I do kind of agree with you, Carrie, and I am being slightly flippant in that I say that they don't have any place at all. But what I will say is that, as you're alluding to, they have to be calibrated properly.
Yeah.
And because if they're not, you just create situations where A, individuals are more likely to be confused than anything else, and B, you also have situations where, as you say, you are introducing challenges to your consistency across the business. And finally, instances where effectively your advice as the DPO or the procedure or whatever, or your authority is potentially undermined because you've put together this form, someone's filled it out, it tells them it's reportable, you look at it, and with your greater experience go, no, actually, it's not reportable. But the form you've designed is telling them that it is, and it puts you in quite a difficult position. What I will say is that, you know, they can be helpful, as you say, but I am simply not having the scale or, you know, volume of records, the number of individuals concerned, be the thing that tips it over the edge. Because I've seen forms where that is assigned a singular value. So if you're talking about number of points and above a certain score, it's reportable. I don't want to see volume or scale as one of those factors. You can multiply, sure, if there's loads of special category records, of course it's going to be worse. But, you know, a lot of less sensitive records being disclosed is not necessarily worse than one extremely sensitive record. And it drives me absolutely mad when I see that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because you could be reporting simply because it's a lot of email addresses, but actually if it's all low level.
Exactly.
And I know what you're saying about that it makes it seem like you have to comply with the form if it says reportable. But in my experience, that if, you know, you may write in why it's not actually reportable, because it might be you've had some mitigations that have happened since the breach that have brought the risk rating down.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm experiencing it from council. So I've, like when I was in council, I dealt with like tons of breaches, so I think I've got we had quite a wide breadth of breaches to sort of assess this against. And I never really had any pushback of if it sort of came out as reportable and we said, oh, you know, maybe we shouldn't report in this instant, or the other way, you know, it says it's not reportable, but actually because of these factors we should report. I think the questions can be really good for getting more information out of staff at the start of it, then the DPO is not having to go back and ask so many questions, because a lot of the time you're repeating the same things. But if you can get those into the questions, get them thinking about it, then you can get more information at the start, and it'll save you time on that 72 hours as well if it is reportable, because you're forcing them to put more information in than just one line of, I sent an email and it had a letter in it, and it's like, okay, what was in the letter?
I know what you mean. Actually, Leslie makes a really good point, which is that if you have that in place, also support it with a manual review, but most importantly, check back over previous breaches to make sure that it's aligned properly and that it's calibrated. Because, you know, there's going to be no greater indicator of whether it's calibrated or properly or not than, you know, past instances. Yeah.
This is where it's harder for smaller, like, off, not for smaller organizations, but maybe organizations that haven't had as many breaches for them to implement it. But if you've got a large number of breaches to calibrate it against, like, I could sometimes do 4 different breaches in one day. That's like the volume of breaches that I was doing. So we had like a very large amount of all varying types of breaches, from like really bad reportable ones to so benign ones that you roll your eyes when you see what's happened. And it worked quite well, but it was always a manual thing. And actually the way that we did it, the report didn't go directly to staff. It was something the DPO, like us as DPO, filled in. We asked the questions, but we used it on our side. We didn't give it to every member of staff. They still they still did breaches on their way, sending it in initially to us in like this little report form thing, like just an online thing with a few basic questions. But then we filled in the risk matrix and everything on our side.
Yeah,
we didn't give it to people in the council to do, because they would have seen everything, because absolutely, you know, the whole council's burning down because I sent an email to the wrong person. They always overestimated everything a lot of the time.
Of course. And Lars makes a good point, which is just the language you use, right? Because if you say that the outcome is likely reportable or likely not reportable, gives you the leeway that you need.
That is a really good way of putting it in there as well. Actually, I might take that last.
Yeah,
That's actually a really good way of putting it, because then it still puts the onus on the DPO or whoever it is in the organisation, because it might not be the DPO, it could be the DPO jointly with senior staff members, like the senior, whoever the CIRO is, they might need to give their input, but it gives you that flexibility of you can lean either way without having to commit at the time of the report.
Sure. I think, Ian also makes a good point, which I guess we were kind of alluding to, but just to draw out really explicitly, that, you know, context is key when you're talking about breaches. So Ian says emails might not be reportable, but the context around the breach, I think, is important, e.g. the historic abuse inquiry email, I think around 90-odd, not being BCC'd. The ICO felt the context was important. The inquirer was fined around £100,000, if he remembers correctly. But that's exactly it, right? You might do something which, you know, in theory doesn't seem like a massive deal, but due to the context associated with it, all of a sudden escalates. I dealt with a breach the other week, and I can't say too much about it, of course, because it's one of our customers. But Zara sat next to me. She'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There's an ongoing ASB, housing client, ongoing ASB between two neighbours. One of them's made a report about the other, and that's been, you know, escalated. The housing officer then wants to deliver, you know, an update to the person who's made the complaint to them, goes around to hand deliver the letter, but because they're not in, they leave it with the neighbour. Guess which neighbour? The one they've complained about. I mean, you know, and all of a sudden there, if you're talking ASB, it's not just a letter with the wrong person, it's a letter with the wrong person, the worst person possible for it. And
that's bad.
It's bad. I mean
depends on the contents of the letter as well. How detailed did they go into the letter about stuff?
And I don't think the ASB was, you know, that significant. But purely from it's bad from the context of how avoidable that is.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean, and how big of a slip up it is to do that sort of thing, because surely it's just common sense that you don't chance it. You just if they're not in, you know, you know whatever, you pop it through the letterbox or whatever.
I'll take it back with you.
Yeah, exactly. But so context is absolutely key. Speaking of context, I wanted to talk a little bit about, Dave, if possible, the only reason I come to you on this is because we've spoken about at length, is root cause analysis, that's okay. Because, again, when we talk about the impact of a breach being, you know, so context dependent, I think also the cause of the breach, you know, the determining factor in that cause is also particularly context specific. And I think sometimes there's a reluctance to conduct, or not necessarily a reluctance, but maybe a lack of awareness that leads to a lack of root cause analysis into these things. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about that with you for a bit, if that's okay. Your experience possibly, because I know that you've been involved in that sort of thing with a number of customers. Obviously, Carrie, please do feel free to join in. But I'm looking to draw Dave on your past experience on this, if that's okay.
For sure, yeah, that's not a problem. Sure.
So, I mean, I conducted some root cause analysis into a quite serious breach for the first time relatively recently. And it, I guess part of the reason that it's not conducted more is that it's actually quite a substantial task, right? To review all the factors associated in the cause of a breach and to try and analyze the single determining factor in what has allowed that to happen. I mean, because that's what we mean by root cause analysis. It's probably worth actually just covering off what we mean by that, isn't it? Do you want to explain a little bit what we mean by root cause analysis? Sorry, we probably should have started there.
Yeah, no, it's a root cause. I mean, you're kind of doing a bit with your non-breach report form. You're kind of doing a bit of analysis, aren't you? You kind of do it not necessarily a whole or a solely focused look on the single point that led to it all happening in that sense. So you can't, you probably do that to a degree through your normal breach reporting forms, but where there's been a really, really serious incident occurred, and I've certainly been involved with several root cause analysis for large scale incidents with organisations, then you do kind of have a bit more of an in-depth look at what was the actual factor that gave rise to it. It's all too easy. I mean, the stats out there, some astonishing stats about from personal data breaches and things like that, saying something around, there's something I was reading earlier that says, it seems a bit obvious to be fair, that human element continues to drive breaches, and that was about 82% of breaches all involved human element. But as you know, before I kind of say, a root cause analysis doesn't necessarily come out with the fact that there's human element, or human error. You tend to look to various different factors that may give rise to it, and is there one single factor that led to that incident occurring, and that not necessarily might have been influenced by human error. But for example, was the individual trained appropriately? Was it a training issue? Was it a system issue? Was this, you know what I mean, in that sense? And it's all that really kind of really targeted, focused look on a kind of a bit of a deep dive, kind of focused look on the incidents and what led to that, to allow you to clearly identify the single point. Can be useful in some cases, but that, as you mentioned, that can be time consuming, can be rather lengthy. So you wouldn't want to do it for the minor issues at all. You'd certainly be looking at the more serious effects.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, generally what you're looking for is the issue before the actual issue, right? You're looking at what has given even the opportunity for this problem to occur. So when I last conducted some root cause analysis on a breach that had happened, the breach itself was to do with, I think, results of, obviously I won't disclose too much, but it was to do with results of subject access requests being sent to the wrong people. And essentially, you know, that's what has caused the breach. You know, it's human error, you could say. But really, looking beyond that, when we investigated, we found that the problem in and of itself was that the SAR processes were not good within the organization. They were too complex. They weren't calibrated well. And while that doesn't necessarily lead to a personal data breach, it might lead to inefficiencies. It might lead to issues with, you know, fulfilling rights requests. In that instance, it exacerbated the risk of human error materializing. And when that human error did materialize, it led to a personal data breach. And, you know, just digging through and... Exactly. And just digging through and looking at it, because sometimes I think it's a... Maybe it's what you're alluding to there. It's sometimes a bit easy to just say it's human error, organizationally, for us to go, well, it's a mistake. Mistakes happen. Well, yeah, mistakes do happen. But if mistakes are consistently happening and those mistakes are having an impact, surely it's not good enough to just say mistakes happen. Do you know what I mean? So I think it is a really valuable exercise if you have the scope to do it. But as we say, it can be quite burdensome and quite time consuming, really. So it's understandable that you might not want to or have the scope to undertake it. Leslie, do you want to comment on this point?
Yeah. Thanks. I was just going to say that I've just put in the blog there that we kind of do, like you were saying before, a root cause analysis on every breach. Even if it's small, you can get back to where it is. And that's sometimes outlined where we've got a pattern of stuff going on. And I hate the term, our executive team use it all the time. It's a, you know, the human element kind of a thing. And it's like, yeah, but it's not just human. There's something specific occurred. It might be a human that's that brought it about, but that doesn't tell me anything as a data protection officer. Okay, it was human error. Really? Well, what does that mean? What has that human done to actually do this? So we do try to get by, even on the simple ones, just to try to identify it. Particularly if there's a pattern, and we've had it before with people not following procedures, the whole thing with email. You know, we have it sometimes with our customer services point of view, where I don't know if everybody else's have it. They're taking things, they've got multiple screens open, they've got this, that, and the other, and things get ended up copying on, and you begin to see a pattern. So you can then try to work with on a bigger piece, if you like, in terms of putting some kind of mitigations in terms of how things, sometimes you can't, sometimes it is what it is. I can't stop them using multiple screens, but it's about that training and education and awareness on those points. But on other areas, it is because, you know, it's the procedure, or they're using a template, but it's not really a template. It's a Word document, and people are copying over from a previous letter instead of setting up a proper template. And some say it can be really easy, but that's been the root cause. So I know it's time consuming. And I think certainly when we have an in-depth one, like you were saying before, we'll go into it in a lot more detail, but we do try to dig down a little bit. Otherwise, we've got no idea why these hundreds of things are occurring at that point in time.
No. I mean, like I said, it's valid. I think to a great lesser degree, I think most people probably are doing some form of root cause analysis to a greater degree. You're kind of looking at the issues around it. You're trying to identify what was the main issue that gave rise to
Absolutely.
It. You're looking at what are the contributory factors that maybe didn't help, but of themselves didn't actually cause that. So you can start looking at action plans around how do we prevent the contributory stuff, how do we fix the contributory stuff, how do we fix the main event in that sense. When I've done the major kind of root cause analysis, I tend to do a lot of investigation around four core areas, and I'm happy to understand if you do the same or look in similar areas, Leslie, or anybody else who's listening. But I tend to focus around people and personnel, processes, environment, and the equipment in that sense, to try and identify, like you said, trying to work out where is this one factor that gave rise to it, where did that fall down in that sense. Was it simply training or system training? Did we advise people how to use the system properly? Was the system actually configured properly in the first place? That kind of thing. Should this have happened in the first place? Was it down to inappropriate permissions being set, and if they'd been revised or reviewed or updated or amended, would that have prevented this from happening, because you wouldn't have had that the capabilities in that sense? So you do try to narrow it down. Sometimes it's quite hard to actually nail down what is the root cause, but it's like I said it is worth kind of going through that focus. But I think we all kind of do it to a greater or lesser degree. It's just maybe not at the sole focus of a kind of an independent report on that.
No, for sure. And Alan's comment is particularly interesting, and I wanted to pick that out if I may. Alan says that regarding root cause analyses, they did some work ages ago. Most major breaches tend to be multifactorial, but they looked particularly at what opportunities there were to stop, limit the breach rather than just the cause/errors, and then how to get better at using those opportunities. And that's sort of going a step further again, where you're not just looking at that root cause, but you're also looking at how you can, where those opportunities to, as you say, mitigate those risks earlier are coming in, and how you can act on them. I mean,
for sure. Just to come in and actually continue. I gleaned this from some legal advice when I was sat with some lawyers and the client talking about bits and pieces. But when you're looking at a root cause analysis, I was advised at this point to really try to identify what the root cause was, and not necessarily the contributory factors, because if you're not careful, especially for cases that are high profile, could end up with court cases, claims for compensation, and so on and so forth. If we're not careful, if you look at the contributory factors in there, you may end up starting to firefight in areas that you don't necessarily need to firefight in when you've got a serious issue on your hand. So the contributory stuff could be in essence your little fires that, yes, there maybe are issues, but because they weren't the sole cause of the issue at hand, we'll focus on those, but just not within the actual root cause kind of analysis. Let's just keep it to the event that gave rise to it where possible, because of, like I say, you don't, certainly don't want to highlight that there's other issues happening in and around the organisation that could have been contributory. Otherwise, instead of having one fire, you might have one big fire, you might have one big fire and several little fires that you suddenly then having to address.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I remember you telling me about that at the time. Alan, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, thanks. It just one simple point that came out of that work that we did, and we did it on the back of a major overhaul of our security breach reporting processes, and we found we had really good reporting processes, but we kind of forgot to tell people that while you're going through these processes in the early hours, do feel free to try and stop the incident.
It's a very valid point.
Very valid point.
Very valid point. People get very sort of very caught up in, let's notify the commissioner, let's get it written up, and what action have you actually taken to stop this?
I actually think it's a really, really valid point. How many people actually have containment as the first step before you start worrying about, or one of the early steps, if not the first step? Can you contain it? Can you stop it becoming any worse? Can we prevent risk from occurring any further, or risks and impact from going ahead any further, and trying to contain the thing before necessarily? Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it's a good point, because, and Carrie, maybe come to you on this, it's quite a delicate balance, because you ideally want to encourage people to, as Dave says, contain the breach at an early stage, nip it in the bud, stop it. But also what you don't want to do is foster a culture of people trying to fix things themselves, because you were mentioning, I think, last week how often you'll have situations where someone goes, oh, I can fix this, I'll just sort it out myself and no one needs to know about it. And if anything, 90% of the time, they end up making it worse, right?
Yeah, it can extend it longer than it needs to, because potentially what they've decided to do as actions to mitigate it and try and stop the breach after the fact is different to what I'd have advised them to do in the first place. And yeah, it's sort of one of the first questions I always ask. So they say, oh, I've done this breach, and I'll be like, okay, well, what have you done about it so far? Because I want to know whether they've done nothing or whether they've done something before I advise what I would think, they should do. Like, the letter's gone to the wrong house and the occupant has phoned up to say that this letter shouldn't be for them, and it's all sensitive information and stuff. It's like, okay, well, has anybody actually thought to go out and get the letter back in person? Oh no, we've just sent a stamped addressed envelope to them. It's like, right, so that's going to take probably 2 days to get to them, and then you're relying on their goodwill to put it in the envelope and give it back. Just go pick it up from the house.
Just go around and pick it up.
Yeah, just go around and pick it up. Like, that's usually the fastest way of preventing it. It's just somebody go around and pick it up. I mean, granted, that is easier in a council where you've got staff all over the county. So yes, you're always going to have somebody in the organisation relatively close by to go pick it up. But no, it can be difficult if people don't tell you about the breach. They can leave it and try to fix it themselves, and it can make things a little bit tricky to try and untangle at the other end when you finally get hold of what's gone on.
Yeah, and I think, and this is another point I want to discuss briefly today, I appreciate that we have just run over our allotted time, but for once I don't actually have my regular meeting after this week, so I'm happy to continue on with this. How are you both fixed for time?
I mean, for once I actually do have a Friday afternoon meeting, so as long as I'm gone by 2, it's all good.
Okay, cool. Well, let's continue on a little bit, but for anyone who has to leave us at this juncture, thank you very much for joining us. Obviously the rest of this goes out as a podcast same day. It'll be up this afternoon, and you'll be able to listen back if you missed anything. One of the things I wanted to talk about, actually, just in relation to that and in terms of people trying to remedy things, potentially make things worse, etc., is potentially instances where you have a conflict of interest where the DPO is the cause of a breach, because it's not as uncommon as it might seem. As we're still only human, we make mistakes. I wanted to know if first of all, either of you had had any experience of in instances like that where the DPO has been the one that's done the breach, and then subsequently, how do you approach that? Do you get someone else to lead it? You know, do you, well, I know that in past instances, the whole process has been outsourced to us as external. Someone's come to us and said, our DPO has been, you know, at fault for this breach. Please, can you come in and investigate? So, yeah, it's just really curious to see if either of you had experiences like that. And if so, how you dealt with it.
I mean, for me, I've not had it with any of my clients at DPP coming to me saying our DPO has done a breach. I think in a lot of cases, we're actually the DPO. At my old role, we were also very similar to DPP, a consultancy of, you know, professionals. And the company was the DPO. So I think, as I said last week, I've actually done a breach. And what ended up happening was I didn't investigate my own breach. I logged it through the normal systems with the correct organisation it was for. And then I think my manager had to then deal with it, which they were super happy about, I'm sure. I gave them a little heads up of what I'd done before it actually came through the actual system. But it was, I would never have investigated my own breach. It would have always been somebody else in the team that would investigate it. You know?
Yeah.
You wouldn't investigate your own work.
I think it would have to be. I don't worry, Carrie, I had to do one for Zara the other week. she's shooting me daggers now. But yeah, no, Dave, any experience on that front? You're always doing breaches left, right, and centre, aren't you?
Beaches, was it? I'm always on the beach. I've come across one. I think I was involved with the case you alluded to where we were involved because there was an issue with the DPO. I think I've got involved with that, but I've not had my own clients come to me directly because of the DPO or the person involved. Is the lead on data protection matters within my client base. So I've seen it through the wider elements of the company, as in DPP, but not directly where the DPO is at fault. Although it's interesting because, like you said, the DPO is only human at the end of the day and is susceptible to everything that means and everything that entails. Clearly, as Carrie alluded to, what you're looking at there is basically not being in a position of conflict. So if the DPO was at the heart of the issue, then you would need somebody within the organisation or external to conduct the necessary investigations and stuff just to show that it's got an air of transparency to it.
I think it would depend on how bad the breach was. I think for a very minor breach, maybe somebody else senior in the organisation could just deal with it and say, yes, this is what's happened and done. If it's something really serious, ICO reportable, potentially, you know, you may need to inform the police or HR or things like that, then yeah, you might need somebody that's external to come in. Because you may have those, I mean, you could have like different relationships between people as well. At those kind of levels, that they might go a bit nicer on the DPO because it's their mate.
Yes,
and
that's
you might
a very
not
good
get that
point.
Proper scrutiny.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key reasons that your processes need to be properly calibrated, because the DPO is not always going to be there to deal with this, or the DPO might not always be the right person to deal with this. So if your breach processes aren't set up properly, or they're not, you know, sufficiently tested, or they're not sufficiently accessible to the wider business. If all of a sudden you have a breach and the DPO is not there, and for some reason, you know, there's no one to cover for that. And if you're someone who's not normally involved in that sort of thing and you all of a sudden have to be a lead investigator, well, you better hope that your breach process are calibrated properly, right? Because otherwise it's potentially
quite
wrong.
Step-by-step data breach dummies kind of thing.
Yeah, I was going to say detailed and calibrated sufficiently so that in essence somebody on the street could take over and have a reasonable go at assessing it for you, or at least on your behalf, that kind of thing. You'd like to think in that situation though that either the DPO somewhere within the organisation, somebody else has got some knowledge. Now, like within organisations, you have data champions or departmental leads for data protection matters and things. You'd like to think within an organisation that there'd be other avenues to call upon in order to support you with that. But we do get some really small SMEs where you might be kind of the sole DPO doing multiple other functions, possibly with or without data as well. So you could easily potentially find yourself in a position of conflict, or at least in the position where the breach was down to the person who's wearing the DPO hat.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think actually one of the best examples, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but one of the best examples of, you know, needing to have that properly calibrated and to communicate what people need to do is, we once had a customer call into us. I remember it was sort of late on a Friday and I was still diligently working away because I'm such a devoted employee. late on a Friday, you know, a customer called in and I was the only one about. I took the call and they said, yeah, you know, we've had this former member of staff who has just gotten in touch with us, and it turns out they were siphoning our data for the past 6 months, all of our customer data, credit card numbers, etc., and they're holding us to ransom. You know, they want us to pay a certain amount, otherwise they'll release all this card data. What do we do? I sort of said, well, that's blackmail. You call the police. It's, you know, there's not much I can, like, I'll help you write the breach report afterwards and we can talk to the ICO if you want. But, like, first instance, call the police. Like, someone is blackmailing you. It's a criminal offence.
Yeah, like, they're lucky that they know who's doing it as well. It's not like a random internet person with that's faceless and nameless. Like, they know who's doing it. Just call the police and tell them where to go.
Yeah, literally. I think, actually, yeah, I think on this point, and there's not too much to be said necessarily, but I thought it was interesting because what we've not talked about much, if at all, over the course of these two sessions, and that's probably, you know, reflects our specific proficiencies and experience, is we've not really spoken about actual cyber attacks. We've not really spoken about ransomware or anything like that. We've spoken more about the personal data breach element.
Yeah,
sorry, go on, Dave.
Actually, it's a really, really good point, because if a personal data breach is a breach of security that's compromised personal data, it doesn't necessarily mean it's got to be a malicious thing. You might associate maliciously with cyber attacks and things. But if you've got data that is not available, let's say, for example, you had paper records, medical records, for example, still kept in paper format in a filing cabinet that was susceptible to fire or flood or water ingress or something like that, that meant that data was lost. That would still be a personal data breach, right? Didn't have to be a malicious thing.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. I mean, what I was getting at, sorry, was more that we've not really spoken about breaches of technical security measures. We've spoken almost exclusively about breaches of organizational security measures, I think. And I thought it was possibly just worth touching on the fact that sometimes, and I really don't have an answer for this, I just want to be clear, but I think it's interesting to explore the idea of how do you reconcile the gap between us as DPOs, as privacy people who are normally, you know, from certain specific backgrounds, with the tech side of things. Because we're not all necessarily, I certainly am not, I'm not an IT guy, I'm not a security guy, I'm not necessarily well versed in it. How do you reconcile that? You know, how do you ensure that you've got synergy with the right people within the business to be able to, because we talked about containment before, right? Now, if it's a case of, as Carrie mentions, you go around, you pick the letter, well, that's pretty straightforward. But if you're suffering a ransomware attack, how, like, and I'm the DPO, I have no idea how to contain that.
Like that'll be where your collaboration skills come in. You pull the people in who can support you with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's
you're
where you go.
IT, today is your day. Yeah.
It's a bit like, on a completely different note, but very similar track. If the DPO was the person tasked with putting the DPIA together, the DPO should still be going to relevant stakeholders and kind of going, I need your input with completing this DPIA. Or you need to complete the DPIA, I'll support you with it, and you need to pull in the applicable stakeholders. Because you look at data protection and privacy, it's a completely different discipline to information security. So therefore, you've got two disciplines that overlap in that sense, but you're not necessarily going to be on top of everything all of the time within both disciplines because of how broad they are. So you're going to have to focus in your area and just know when to pull the relevant stakeholders in to support you with that, or like with the DPIA, to suggest that they're going to speak to them themselves and you'll support them with that. But it's you might be the front of all knowledge data protection issue-ish, but from a DPO, you really got to know where your limits lie and how to address those when what you're dealing with starts to encroach into those areas.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I just thought it was worth raising because obviously we've not really spoken about it too much. There are a couple of other things. I'm conscious of the time because even though we've said we'll stick about a bit, obviously we can't go mad either. The other two bits or the other couple of bits really that I wanted to talk about ideally, I'm not sure whether there's scope for maybe a third episode but or whether we're overstretching ourselves, but we didn't necessarily get as much into systems training as I wanted to. Because we mentioned that last week, I think that's something that's worth talking about. One of the things I wanted to cover, but I don't know if there's anything in this, is how often you, the two of you, are confronted with this idea of have we committed a personal data breach? No, you've breached a part of the GDPR. this is not lawful or it is not transparent, but it is not a personal data breach. And how do you communicate that?
Absolutely. And I'm probably going down the wrong line with this, so please tell me to wind it in if you like. But can you breach part of the GDPR, or is it just an infringement of the articles that you're talking about?
That is semantics. I'm not going to dignify it with a response. Semantics, Dave. I mean, but you know what I'm getting at, right? That, like, sometimes someone will come to you, like, we've had this thing, like, we had a... So the one I had recently was a resident with a housing provider had made a complaint because their data had been used as part of something, and they weren't aware of that, and they were not happy that it had been used. And I said, and they were like, oh, is it a personal data breach? I said, well, it's not, because you've not breached any security measures. There's been no unauthorized processing. However, what you've done is clearly you've not sufficiently communicated that purpose of processing to that individual.
Would that not fall as an organizational measure, ensuring that you've got, when you look at technical and organizational measures implemented to ensure that you meet the requirements of the regulation, if the part of the regulation is to be fair, lawful and transparent processing under the principles, would that not be how you adhere to the principles? Would that not be an organizational measure?
No, because the specific processing was called out in privacy information, which the individual had access to, but clearly they had not realized that. So whether they'd not gone on Reddit or whatever, but I get what you're getting at, but I do think you're extrapolating slightly there as far as, you know, I'm concerned. But I was basically saying, you know, I don't think this is a personal data breach, but I do think what you've got here is a problem with your compliance with the transparency requirement, which is, so this is where it is semantic. Well, is that a breach of the law, an infringement of the requirement, whatever you want to call it, but it's not a personal data breach within the meaning of that definition.
Well, if they were being transparent and not transparent enough, then you said there's potentially an issue with transparency, but you are being transparent. But if you really weren't being transparent, I would still say that potentially you've got a personal data breach on an organizational measure, because the in my eyes, I'm happy to be told I'm wrong, in my eyes, the organizational, when you're going through the organizational measures, like with the data protection by design and by default, you're ensuring that you've got appropriate technical organizational measures in place to ensure that you adhere to the requirements of the regulation, and the principles are a requirement of the regulation.
Point taken, but I still don't think that leads to one of the listed consequences. I don't think that leads to unauthorized, unlawful processing, access, etc.
No, so then if it didn't lead to that, then you've just got a security incident, not a personal data breach by the definition.
Okay, we're at risk here of going around in circles. Really, what I was hoping was that Carrie weighed in on this and you know, ring the bell and bring that argument to a close. But I'm going to have to pick this up with you off air, Dave, because I want to get into that more. But that's one of the things I wanted to raise this week. I also thought it was maybe worth talking about the other two points I've got down here. I don't know if either of you have checked down to the bottom of the notes. The other two points I've got are more of a question, really. First of all, has anyone ever actually had the ICO come back and ask for more information after you've reported a breach? I know you have, Dave, because you've been involved in some quite complex ones, but more of a point of, I know it's one of the things that you often say is, you know, you give assurances to the ICO, but do they ever follow up to actually check that you're doing what you say you've said you'll do? That's, I think, something that maybe is worth talking about if we ever did a third episode on this or another one.
I've not seen that point. I've seen where they ask for more information, but I've not seen them come back to say, can you demonstrate that you've completed your action plan to correct what went wrong? I've certainly seen them ask for the action plan, but not seen them come back and say, can you demonstrate you've completed it?
Are you thinking of that question, Ollie, more that after you've done your initial report, do they come back with questions, or after you've done your initial report, they've sent you back no further action, do they get questions after the no further action point?
I left it intentionally broad in that respect, but yeah, kind of both, really.
Had questions after the first initial report. I once had to answer about 20 questions in about 2 weeks. That was really fun in response to initial report. But after having that no further action, nothing ever has ever come back after that about a breach.
Fair enough.
Like they give you no further action and then they don't do anything, like David says, they don't follow up. They don't actually check whether recommendations you said they're going to do, you've actually done.
Yeah, no, this is why I was curious. Yeah. No, so that was one of the things. And the last one, just to bring it to a close, is whether anyone on the session has to date paid out on a compensation claim as a result of a breach. Because we talk about these representative actions or these claims for damages because of personal data breaches, and whether anyone has actually, you know, been through the process themselves, whether anyone's paid out on them, whether anyone has found alternative methods to satisfy those claims for damages. So I know, Dave, that one of the things that you've discussed before is you don't necessarily have to, you know, it doesn't have to be monetary damages that you're, you know, providing. You can also, one of the things that you mentioned to me was card data was breached, so an account monitoring solution was offered to victims of the breach, as opposed to actually, you know, a lump sum payout, right?
Well, it comes to the point, if the individual is saying you've caused this issue and I'm at risk of cyber attack or some kind of fraudulent element, well, surely fraud monitoring would be worth more to them, to alert them on, to make sure that the bank's picking up on bits and pieces to prevent that, as opposed to saying, here's 200 quid. 200 quid's not going to prevent the fraud, whereas fraud monitoring may do. So therefore, it's kind of going down that essence with, well, surely fraud monitoring will be worth more to you than just a couple of hundred quid.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I subscribe to that. And it's one of the things I often go back with whenever we're faced with one of those queries, which... go through phases. We do get a few of them, but
no, not, for sure. The difficulty would be coming where, if you've had a serious data breach, the individual is having under refuge from domestic violence and feel that their location and their identity is being compromised and they're no longer safe in that location. Now, that may mean you've got to move their location or find them another refuge quite quickly, or do something to protect their from physical and mental distress. And so on and so forth. So I'm not suggesting that those kind of measures are always there, but I don't think we need to always think that compensatory measures means cash, because it doesn't necessarily have to.
And that was kind of the crux of slight tangent, but in TLT and others versus the Home Office, that's one of the issues, is people having to be displaced. But again, in that instance, you know, offered a cash payout. People are having to get off, and Carrie, we certainly don't want to make you late for your next meeting, especially as we have to record the intro for this as well afterwards.
I forgot that bit.
you can get off me too, David. I can. David,
yeah, we'll do it quickly. I've got a meeting with Rob coming up at 2, so we'll.
I'll skip it this week.
Okay. We'll do it quickly, Ollie, and then we'll I'll jump in the meeting with Rob.
Worst comes to worst, producer Mars and I can do it. Anyway,
just in case Rob's listening, I might be a couple of minutes late.
Dave, people don't need to hear this. For crying out loud, let me finish. Right, let's bring this chaotic mess to an end. Thank you, Carrie and Dave, for your time, efforts and thoughts and insights once again. I very much enjoyed kicking those items around. Hopefully you, the listener, also enjoyed that. Thank you very much for your time, and we do hope to see you very soon. As I say, we're not back live next week. We're putting out a pre-recorded episode over the Jubilee Bank Holiday weekend, but we'll be back the week after that with another live session. So if you want to sign up to that, do head over to the DPP website. On the events page, you can sign up for a live link. And remember that all of these are recorded and put out afterwards, same day, in the form of the podcast on the DPP website or on any audio streaming platforms. On that note, I will take a breath and we shall leave it there. Thank you all very much for your time, and we will catch up with you very soon.
Thank you.